This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca. You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Rabble.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
After the passing of the anti-gay bill in Uganda, one of the two options that were put on the table for me was you either seek asylum or seek asylum. Like, there was no other option for me.
To the Hum.
So we're joined today by Cleopatra Kambugu, one of the few openly trans women in Uganda or Africa, and her main squeeze, the one and only, the lovely Nelson Kaseja. How are you guys today?
We're good.
I'm fine. Very good.
Thank you so much for joining us. How are you guys finding the weather here in Toronto?
It's lovely from the last time I was here.
You were back here in February?
I was here in February earlier on, before you guys had some good weather that turned horrible.
So you guys are visiting us because you're the subjects of a wonderful film that's playing in the city right now as part of the Hot Ducks Festival. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to start by asking you about Uganda, your homeland. You know, we hear a lot of the stories sort of as Westerners about a lot of the discrimination and some of the things that are happening in Uganda, but we wanted to hear it from yourselves as well. What is Uganda like as a place for people from Canada that might not have heard about it?
Uganda is, well, it's called the Pearl of Africa, ironically. And it's a place for it's friendly people. They're good. And I guess what is portrayed in the media, like today earlier I was speaking to another Canadian, and she was telling me that the only thing they hear about Uganda or Africa is the negative stuff from the TVs and radio news. And they don't portray what actually happens in Africa, and it takes someone to really be there. So not everything about Uganda is bad. But I guess when Uganda and the current government passed the anti-gay homosexual bill, and that took a lot of media attention, and it was portrayed in a very bad way, I guess that's what most people know about Uganda. But in a nutshell, Uganda is a very good country. I mean, we have good weather.
That's a bonus.
Yeah. We don't know about that in Canada.
Yeah, it shines all the time.
It's 7 degrees today. I'm happy.
This is good for us. I was curious about growing up there. What was that like for you, Cleopatra? Can you tell us about your childhood and when you started to come into your own and understand your own gender identity, and you know, what was it like growing up as someone struggling with your own identity issues?
I grew up in a family of 15. That's 12 kids and a couple of mothers and my dad. As an infant and up until that age when I was 10, I was kind of queer presenting, bordering androgynous, but it wasn't an issue because normally kids' expression is not sexualized. Like, everyone says, oh, it's just kids being kids just playing. And my parents thought I would grow out of it. But I remember from the time I was young, I used to love playing with dolls. I wore flamboyant clothes. Everything about me spelled out girl. I know that hobbies are gendered, but I was bordering the opposite. And I didn't think about it a lot. I didn't even worry about it. I guess me noticing that I was different was when I was about 12 or 13, entering puberty, entering my teenage years, when the roles for boys and girls suddenly split, and suddenly boys and girls didn't play the same games, didn't hang out together because it wasn't cool, had different lodging, and then that's when it struck me that I was different, that I was on the opposite side of the gender that was assigned on my birth certificate. And that's when it struck my parents that I need to change. I remember during my teenage years being thrown into a boys' dormitory from my high school. And it was so much hell because I got sexually abused. And it's not something I could tell anyone back then because I thought to myself that I would be blamed for being girly, which was the reason why I was abused. So I never told anyone. I didn't tell my brother, I didn't tell my sister, I didn't tell my mom or dad up until that point when I came out at 25. And they felt bad that I didn't tell them. I would basically describe my teenage years as loneliness in a crowd because I had so many friends around me. I knew everything about all their relationship dynamics and all their drama, but they knew nothing about me. They knew nothing about the deeper demons I dealt with that night when I went to bed. And that was the ultimate loneliness for me.
Can you speak more about what it's like to grow up identifying maybe in that LGBT community within Uganda? How does Uganda look at people from that community? How's it received?
The time I grew up, the time when I was navigating my teenage years, there wasn't any media coverage about queer love or homosexuality or transgender people. This is something that maybe teenagers of now might know about. But when I was growing up, no one talked about that like ever. I didn't even know about kissing until I was 13. So that's how much we don't talk about sexuality and gender back home. So it was hard because I didn't have a blueprint to reference to like being a transgender teen 101. I didn't have that. And I definitely couldn't ask anyone because there's an untold drugness about being a boy who identifies as a girl, especially in Africa, which is very patriarchal and cis-normative with all the misogyny. Because being a woman in Africa is seen as being less of a person. So everyone would ask themselves, why are you degrading yourself to womanhood? I guess that's how I would compare it as, and all the backlash that comes with that.
Where do you think the shift came in Uganda where the politicians and the political class decided that this was something they wanted to tackle and they didn't need to write laws? When did it become a political sort of anti-gay, anti-LGBT movement in Uganda?
Up until the age when I was going to my university, there wasn't so much narrative out there about queer people or the queer movement. The queer movement started being vibrant from around 2005, and all the changes that have been made have been in this very short period of time. But before that, before 2005, there wasn't so much happening in the media. No one really knew about queer people or the queer movement ever being in Uganda. Yeah, I guess we knew there were countries that had queer people, but we didn't know that that would be someone who would be your friend or your brother or your sister. Yeah, I know we used to see queer people in Jerry Springer and Oprah, but that was it. It seemed like watching life on Mars and knowing you'll never get there.
Jerry Springer is never a great gateway into any form of life.
Yeah. But that's basically who I think that's where I first saw a transgender person, and Oprah Winfrey a couple of times when she was featuring a person who had had a sex change surgery. But we used to look at these things like fantastical tales that could never, it's like talking about a unicorn. It will never happen to you. Of course, when we would watch those shows, my siblings would liken those people to me, that if any person would ever have a sex change, it would be me. But it was never something we talked about that was ever in the realm of ever happening. But after 2005, what really changed is that the LGBTI community came up with a lot of vigor and challenged so many things, challenged Africa, to challenge Uganda to start speaking about sexuality and gender. We do not talk about sexuality and gender as a people because it's that huge elephant in the room that no one wants to acknowledge exists. And we were challenged to start talking about it. And that was huge. And with that came the backlash from the religious leaders through Scott Lively, who came to our country and did a huge, massive campaign against LGBTI people, highlighting family values and recruitment of children and the decay of the moral fabric as one of the huge things.
I guess what really changed Uganda was the advent of the internet. With the increased internet penetration in Uganda, and this began around 2004 when Facebook launched, and people were able to actually now open up the world. I mean, before, it was very hard for us to access the internet. You had to go to a cafe, you had to, and we didn't have smartphones or anything like that. But from 2004, 2005 and onwards, the internet penetration increased in Uganda, and with that, it opened up all sorts of doors. And one of them was that people actually knew about, you know, that there's actually LGBT people in the world. And that is when the ball started rolling, and that is when even the movement, I think, in Uganda also picked up much more than before. Because before, we didn't have any literature about it. We didn't know. And those who knew were the select few who could actually afford to have internet before then. So that also helped to spur up the penetration.
When you were seeing things like this, the Jerry Springer thing you were talking about, and, and you know, Oprah and all this stuff, did you have moments where you felt like you started to understand yourself better because of this access to these things? Or when did it start to dawn on you, you know, who you really were?
I think I had always known my identifying myself as a trans person, to me, doesn't mean that I became transgender. I was actually born a transgender person. I'm a cisgendered male. I'm a cisgendered female, but I'm a transgender person. And I've always been that. There's never a time I felt as I was cis male or any maleness in me. I was assigned male at birth, but there was never a time, even from my childhood, where I felt male. But there was also never a time where I can't really define my lived realities as being those of a cisgendered woman either, because I've experienced male privilege by virtue of what I was assigned with at birth. I've experienced the pressure of being a cisgendered male person who is effeminate, because I was very effeminate presenting, so I know what the pressure that society puts on men, on people who identify as male, to live up to manhood. And with my transitioning, I've been able to experience, like, all my privilege of being a male person. That crown was removed from my head, and I was forced to wear a crown of vulnerability and oppression that is subjected to women. And of all the things that I read out there, no one prepared me for that. No one prepared me for how it would feel to walk down the street and be scared that someone might attack you because you're a woman and you're the weaker sex. Not because you're transgender, but because you're a female person. No one prepared me to the fact that my voice would be less hard, or I would work twice as hard and shout twice as hard to be heard as a woman. And that in some spaces, I would never access them as I used to before as a male person. I'm the firstborn son of my mom. I should be the one inheriting my dad's property, like land and stuff like that. But in my culture, women are not allowed to inherit land or property. So me being transgender and saying I'm a trans woman, I can't own land. I can never inherit my dad's property because women can't inherit that. And that's a reality I have to live with. And that helps me understand what women go through. So when you ask me what it means like to be transgender back in Uganda, it's all those things really. It's not just the being a trans person whose gender expression is not coherent with what they look like physically, like before I had my hormones, but it's also all those other things that I never got prepared for.
When you are speaking, Nelson has these love eyes on you, and I noticed that when he was speaking earlier, you're just sitting here, one hand on the cheek, staring at him in love. I saw the film at Hot Dogs. You guys are madly in love. I want to talk about that. How did you two meet?
Oh, well,
love eyes are back on, by the way.
Yeah. I'll set them off. We met in high school, and happened to be transferred from another school to the school Cleo was in. I remember meeting this person who was presenting male, and us coming from a background where, well, I was a straight guy. And I mean, by being a straight guy, you can tell that, no, this is a girl. I mean, this definitely is not a guy. I mean, this definitely is not a guy. And there's something about her, I don't know. And this is, you know, before we, I never had anything about transgender. I never had she at the time.
You haven't seen that Jerry Springer episode?
Yeah. Which is why I was saying earlier that she had the privilege of watching it. Me, I didn't have the privilege of even watching Jerry Springer. So we didn't even know anything about that, or opera, you know, for that matter. But still, with my naive eyes, I could still see that this is someone different. And we became friends because she was very friendly. She was very talkative. So she helped to welcome me to the school and help me acclimatize. And I guess I fell in love like that, friendship, you know, friends become lovers, that's all story. And that is how we were. And through all the journey of navigating and her discovering herself and learning who she is and even telling me, you know, Nelson, I'm actually transgender, because I didn't know who I was. Because at the time I met her, she did not know that she was transgender. I don't know, I think she had even heard of the word transgender before. But through all that and through us struggling to learn, her struggling to learn, her looking for literature, well, I was there. And that is how we have been ever since.
So this journey of learning kind of happened together for both of you.
Mm. Yeah.
And do you think that kind of strengthened your bond, learning about these issues and learning about what Cleo was going through? Do you think that being so young together and learning these things together is why you're so close today?
Yeah, I think so. I think that in itself had a very big effect. Yeah, because I imagine if I had met her right now when she had already transitioned, since we were both straight out of high school and young and growing together, I think that was a very big impact. It impacted a lot on our friendship, our bond, our love, especially the learning process, because even in as much as I liked her and I wanted to be with her, I couldn't be with her, not in Uganda. I mean, you couldn't go out with your friends and say, hey, this is my girlfriend. No. So the secrecy, the hiding, and the bearing, the explaining, and, you know, because like, no one wants, you know, to date someone in hiding, that helped us strengthen our love and say, you know, one day something will change. One day this will change.
Where are you both living right now?
We're both living in Nairobi.
In Nairobi, and what brought you there?
Well, one morning we were happily in Kampala, and the next she was outed in the papers. And after that, it was a roller coaster. We had to basically flee Kampala because it wasn't safe for her anymore. And with that, it wasn't safe for me. I had to leave my job because they had seen her and they knew she was, well, they knew she was a cisgender woman. So, and now they're outing her as this. I couldn't go back. She couldn't go back. We stayed in the house for close to 2 months. We were just feeding off our parents. They brought us food. It was so hard, you know, being there. Even me, well, I had to sometimes brave myself and sneak out and, you know, go get a small grocery and come back and had to be after dark. We really had no choice. We had to leave and she had to go first. I remember she left, it was raining. We didn't even have enough money to leave, so she had to get, you know, in Kampala we have these motorcycle taxis. So with a suitcase on and goodbye. Like a tuk-tuk, if you know a tuk-tuk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you imagine sitting on a tuk-tuk with no cover, with your suitcase, and straight to the airport, and I told her, you know, just get out of here. I mean, I will come and join you, but I may try to with or whatever will come, but for you, it's not going to be the same.
So it was, you felt the danger was that imminent once Cleo was outed that you just had to make that decision and go?
Yeah, because it was not only about the law coming out, because it's not like before there was no hostility. The hostility was there, but when the law came out, it gave people a reason to actually attack people from the LGBT And now they had a reason to hunt. They were actually manhunts. Even if you know someone, you are an accomplice, you are a neighbor, and you know someone who is in the LGBTI community or who is gay or transgender or lesbian, and you shelter them, you too also go to prison. So that addition was put there, I think, specifically to make people out, other people out. Mm. And that's what made people so scared. Mm. So even if I had a friend who knew that Cleo was transgender, for his own safety, he would rather give me there. So that's what made it so much even unsafe. Not only were they targeting them, not even targeting the family around them. And I think Cleo will tell you, her own brother called her and said, please delete my number. And if they ask me, do I know you? I'll say, I don't know you. And I heard her, you know, talking on the phone, and I know she was crying. And like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, yeah, but that is what it has come down to.
Cleo, are you able to stay in touch with family back home and friends back home? And are both of you aware of the people that weren't able to leave or the people that weren't able to get out in time? Can you tell us about some of the struggles there now?
I'm still able to get in touch with family back home. It's pretty hard to go back home, though, because whenever I'm flying back home, it needs to be discreet, in secret. I already stopped at border points and asked to change my documents and asked about, like, what's up with your passport? Why does it read male? Why does this person look different? Are you a terrorist? Stuff like that. Some people know, and they just ask to humiliate you in a long queue, and they'll be shouting over the whole queue, are you a man or a woman? I've had that happen twice, just to make you feel humiliated. I think like once or twice I've had to be subjected to an involuntary medical checkup just to prove, physical check, just to prove that I'm a transgender person who had had a sex change surgery. I did it to set precedent for other trans people so they don't go through the same. So I told this particular border control person that if you ever see another person who has a passport that reads different but looks different, they have the same condition as I do. So please don't undignify them to the extent of having to strip them, because how would you feel if you had to strip at every airport you go to just to be able to cross countries? It would have been easy for me to seek asylum. But it was two things that I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to do this because I would never be able to see Nelson again. And I couldn't fathom not ever being able to see Nelson again for I don't know how long. Or not being able to see my mom and being told after I don't know how many months that my mom has had an accident or she's dead or something and I can't come to visit or even bury her. That worried me. That freaked me out completely. But also, it felt so defeatist, me having to leave home. I didn't do anything after I was outed in the papers, but I felt like by seeking asylum as throwing in the flag, I really wanted a last throw at them. I wanted to do one last thing. I didn't do anything right away at that point because I felt like I had put my family in trouble and my friends in trouble, and Nelson had lost his job. I felt responsible. So I didn't want to do anything at that moment. And I did nothing. And it was so annoying not to be able to do anything and have all these people keep on writing all these things about you and have to be locked up in a house for 2 months knowing you can't go and speak about it on any radio station or do anything. And my Facebook went quiet because my parents advised me, please don't do anything. Your anonymity has been broken. Please don't do anything. Lucky for me, I didn't have to seek asylum. I was able to come to Nairobi and work with another organization called Uhai Ishri, which is an indigenous activist fund that works to support LGBT organizing in Eastern Africa. But for many other people who identify as trans and queer, most weren't able to cross the border. Some have since crossed the border to come to Kenya to the UNHCR camp in Kakuma. The people who remain back home, a couple of them have been... I've had very horrible stories of some of them being... There's this thing called cleansing.
Cleansing?
Yeah, sort of like your family does an intervention. Like, you don't know that you're coming back home to this. So you just get back home and you have everyone seated in their room and they tell you about how they know about everything you've been doing and they'll either tie you up or take you to a healer, or it really ranges from being taken to a healer or being taken to a church to be cleansed of demons to being whipped so that the demons get out of you, because we are very spiritual people. What also has happened that I've had during the interim of the passing of that bill, there's a group of vigilante men who took it to themselves to capture gay people and take them to a safe house and beat them up. Yeah, beat them to thrashes. So they would let you go after a while. They would get your phone and they would call another person and tell you that, you know what? Max has had an issue. He's been beaten up because of ABCD. Please come and help him. He's in this place. He's at Bloor Street. So you would come thinking that you're going to come and save Max, and they would get you and beat you up as well and take your phone and let you go without your phone and call the next number, because they figured, I guess, that if I get a gay person, they'll know another gay person, right? So they just beat up people like that for like 3 weeks until we reported this case to police officers. But when they realized why these boys were being beaten up, that it's because they were gay, they felt like that was justified.
It's so frustrating to see these, I think you used the term superficial identifiers.
Yeah.
To pin people down on from a government level all the way down to a community level. I want to ask you both, you're both the subject of a film, The Pearl of Africa.
Yeah.
I know how annoying it is, even when my girlfriend just turns the camera on to take like a 5-second video of me just cooking breakfast. I get so awkward. I want to ask, what was the process like for the two of you to have this whole process documented? Because there were some very intimate moments from you guys hanging out. I remember on top of a hill,
mm-hmm.
It was Nelson's trying to act funny in front of a gangster pose. From playful things like that all the way to serious moments in Thailand as you're preparing for the surgery, but also as you're awakening from your surgery.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, opening up?
For me, I had done a lot of media work, so it was not difficult. But I would say that even for me, because we shot for 3 years, so you get more comfortable with that camera as time goes on. You'll know that you will have someone hearing you all the time and you need to get on with your life. So just get on with your life. For Nelson, I know that Nelson is an introvert and he's not an activist. He's another person who is dating a person who happens to be an activist and who's very passionate about human rights. And, you know, it was an issue initially of, I need to support my girlfriend. And I know we had a very huge conversation about convincing him to do this. But the Pearl of Africa grew on us. It morphed us, it changed us, it grew us. And it grew him. It grew him to being able to appreciate him why we are doing this.
In the beginning, it really sucked. Like you said, I didn't like the camera. In my personal space, it was really not so easy to take in at first. I really asked a lot, and I wanted to know exactly what is the Pearl of Africa going to help, and then who is it going to help. I don't feel like it's helping me at all, because it's actually pissing me off having someone there all the time. But like Leo said, eventually I appreciated it and I got to know that, you know, this is something that's going to be bigger than me. And I might have my feelings towards having someone there, but this is even bigger than that. And through the story, I guess the next transgender person out there watching the movie, or the next guy dating a transgender person, from my perspective, would also appreciate that and know exactly what to expect, what to go through, and maybe they'll pick up something or two so they won't have to go through what we went through.
So if the filmmakers want to make a sequel, you're in or no?
No, definitely I'll be in. It was hard shooting Cleo in Thailand, but you know, it was only me, Cleo, and Johnny, the director. And even though Johnny was filming, he was the only person there. So I also needed someone there. Otherwise, I'd have also gone crazy. I mean, being scared, being nervous and anxious. So after 3 years, we became like a family. And we let him in, and that also helped.
There's one part of the movie that I think you do best in, and it's when you don't know that the microphone is on. That was so memorable. I want to ask, in a perfect world, in a perfect, perfect world, a dream world, how does all this end? What's next?
In a perfect world for myself would be to be able to change my documents, to be able to show that part of Africa back home, and have a new conversation, a new revolution around people appreciating transgender people and the need for transgender healthcare. In a perfect world, I would see the Pearl of Africa sweep through the whole world and create a thinking about how differently that trans narrative should be told, as not being heavy on victimhood and sensationalizing of stories and sexualizing of trans realities and policing of trans women, to one of agency and resilience and love and humanity, one of hope. I don't like it when the only story that are told about minorities are sad stories. And I think Canada has one of those as well with the First Nations. The only time we hear about the First Nations is when there is suicide or something bad has happened in the camps. And that's sad, because who talks about the positive narratives, the narratives of hope, the narratives of great things that the First Nations are doing? Same over here. To have a narrative where another cisgendered man who's dating a transgender person, who's struggling with having their masculinity questioned and their heterosexuality questioned because they are dating a transgender person, how do they deal with this? How do they deal with their family accepting this woman who is different from the next woman, and all the expectations that won't be fulfilled just because they're dating a transgender person? How do they deal with that? I think Nelson gives them an insight into how you deal with that, and an insight into saying that I'm a cisgendered heterosexual man who's dating a transgender woman in Uganda. You should be able to deal with that kind of hope and resilience that he shows. I remember a point when my mom asked me, so you're dating Nelson, yeah. So what's wrong with Nelson? What she was basically asking is, why would a cisgendered heterosexual man date a transgender woman like you, knowing what that comes with, when there are all other cisgendered women out there whom he can date without whatever
without
would come, without all the liabilities? She asked that question because she was wondering why he would have to go through that. And for me, that's love. That's love. That's the truest form of love. To date someone unconditionally, irrespective of if it will be good or bad. You know it will be bad, but you still date this person. The future is clear. You know it will be bad, but you still date this person. Yeah, just that.
And I will just add that to any person in Canada, dating a transgender person, it's not what people are going to say, because people would always have an opinion about you regardless. But if you are with someone, you look at them and not look at what people say about them. Mm. Like when you had asked earlier what would be the perfect ending to the movie, for me it would be just to take Cleo out with the guys and, you know, they don't have to look at her like transgender. That would, for me, be the perfect, perfect ending. I want to see that happen, and not only for me, but for everyone. For us to reach a point where we're not putting labels to anyone. I guess it's just to be more resilient. Yes, you're going to always have hurdles, but just know that you're not alone. And we are all here, and if you work together, change will definitely come.